Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. Hey guys, back to metabolic health today and insulin. So we have Dr. Donal Collins, who's the GP, an NHS GP in the UK, who has now moved into creating a whole infrastructure, a business around insulin resistance and resolving that in all their clients. And it's going really well. And we also have Gabor Erdoshi, who's a molecular biologist. Many of you may know him, but he's moved way beyond his original biology and has thousands of scientific papers in immunology, metabolic health, insulin, glucose, everything. So he's kind of an all-round genius. Isn't that right, Gabor?
I'm not sure. I don't like bragging that much around, but I have a few thousand papers, and I even read a few thousand papers overall.
No, but don't worry.
The important thing is what you remember.
Exactly. Yeah, a friend of mine used to say, "I've forgotten more than you know about X, whatever subject." So yeah, Donal, great to have you here. And we might kick off with yourself and your kind of story, because you have a backstory on your own metabolic health before you kind of discovered a lot of things and then moved into this new venture.
Yeah, great for having me on, Ivor. Thank you so much. So I was an NHS GP for 25 years until October just gone by. And for about 5 years before that, I was involved in NHS Vanguard work. So it was kind of ironic. So I was leading some transformational changes to try and prevent long-term diseases occurring in our populations. And during this time, I myself developed a chronic preventable long-term condition. As we have a wonderful job, we've got wonderful patients, they keep giving us boxes of chocolates, biscuits, cakes. So anytime I came out from a patient, you grab a cup of tea, you grab several biscuits and a few sweets. And guess what? Over the years, my belly ballooned. And then one time I noted that I was getting exceptionally tired, couldn't wait to get to bed, absolutely exhausted. Clarity of thought went, and it was difficulty remembering stuff. I went and got my bloods done, and much to my horror, I had a HbA1c of 68. So I work in the NHS, so I tell my patients to do stuff, so I thought I need to be a patient. So I went to see my GP, he put me on some drugs and told me the usual advice of eat less and move more, doc, and you will fix your diabetes. At that time, I thought, okay, if that's what I need to do, let's do this in my surgery. And I invited Weight Watchers into our surgery. Weight Watchers was funded by, and still is, by the NHS to help people lose weight. So I joined the queue every week with my patients. I did what I was told. It was tough. So I found I was hungry all the time. I was constantly thinking of food. But I lost 5 kilos, which is the magic number to say your diabetes is going to get better. So once I hit that loss, I went off and got my bloods done. And my HbA1c came back at 68, which might sound familiar because that was exactly the number I just told you earlier in the program. No budge, weight down, and I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. And around this time, one of my patients came in, really interesting guy, in his early 40s, Southeast Asian, BMI 24. He presented with a HbA1c of 100. I said to him, you need drugs, and I'm the guy to give them to you. And he said, hang on a second, I'm an engineer. And I think I know what's going on, and can you let me try and fix the root problem? And I said, okay, you fix your root problem, knowing I'd have to give him drugs anyway. And he came back a few months later and his HbA1c went down to 60. And I said, look, you've done really well. You know, you still need drugs. And he said, well, I've only partially done what I should have done. Let me work harder. And he came back and his HbA1c came back at 38 and he sustained it under 40 for the next couple of years. So I had a chat with him to say, well, what have you done? And he said, well, in our society, we eat lots of rice, we eat lots of chapatis and lots of high sugary food. So I stopped eating the sugar I stopped adding the fast absorbing carbohydrates to my diet. And guess what? I fixed my type 2 diabetes. So this was a bit of a revelation to me. So I did some research and I started listening to podcasts, and I came across this guy called Ivor Cummins, who did an amazing podcast on how to reverse chronic disease. And it was staggering because I'd been taught for 20 years, type 2 diabetes can't be reversed. It's a chronically progressive disease. And yet around me, people were reversing their disease. So I decided I'd give this a go. And lo and behold, within months, my sugars crashed. I lost 17 kilograms since I started putting cream in my coffee. And HbA1c came back at 44 and has maintained around that level. So technically, as I've kept it under 48, diabetes in remission, off drugs. And on one of your podcasts, you talked about the ability to measure insulin will be a game changer. Now, I know in Ireland, people can go in and just ask for an insulin test and it's done. But in the NHS, it's incredibly hard. You need to have an insulinoma or special permission from the laboratory in the hospital to get an insulin level done. So when I heard about the fact that you could get insulin measured by a finger prick test, not needing a laboratory, and you think, actually, this could be done at home by patients as well, suddenly you're democratizing access to health. We could give knowledge and empower people to turn their lives around. So my plan was always to change my career. This has powered me and set me up to do something radically different. So we set this clinic up and we've been doing this. And the response from the patients has been phenomenal. So if you tell patients, stop eating sugar and stop adding fast-acting carbohydrates to your diet, they kind of nod and say, yeah, I kind of heard that before. But when you show them what's happening in the bloodstream, sugar response to food, insulin response to food, it is amazingly empowering. And they go away feeling positive, empowered. They know exactly what to do.
Yeah, that's again, fantastic job there, Donal. I know we met a few years ago in Dublin. You told me your story then. But like, you know, even though if you know the technology and you understand it and you find out you can do it, it still requires effort and fairness and to carry it through and not kind of get stressed out and busy at work and let it slip and lose ground. So it's always a huge achievement to do that. The insulin, absolutely. I was really excited years ago when I met Eric Smith for the first time. I think it was in Denver, or it could have been in Breckenridge or God knows where in America at a conference. And he showed me this really early finger prick insulin test. And I thought, yeah, well, you know, that's amazing. But when's it going to actually commercialize? Because I spent a long time in high volume products and I know it's a lot of work to get it scaled and really out there. But it looks like now, and Gabor, you can chip in here as well, because you're involved with Eric working on this, and I promoted the product a few months ago in a few videos. It's pretty much going very well technologically, right?
Yeah, we have made a lot of progress since, partly thanks to Donna. We now have a nicely working smartphone app, and also a kind of a shooting box. We tried to solve this, the quality of the shot you take of the lateral flow assay is rather important. And we figured that the single biggest difference between shots was the lighting. And we couldn't fix because different smartphones have different flashes and the lighting in the rooms can be vastly different. So finally, we arrived to a black box on top of which you just put your smartphone and then all the external light issues are solved immediately. So it's just a small box. There is a drawer. You insert the LFA strip and then take the picture with the smartphone app. And then it sends the picture to a cloud server, and then you get back the result almost instantaneously. And it can be plugged into a analytics software, so you can get the nice curves as well.
Excellent. And I remember seeing even way back, I met Eric again in London, the actual correlation curves versus laboratory testing. And it was pretty damn good, even at a very earlier stage. Now, the black box you're talking about, I guess you bypass the light source from the phone and the environment. Do you have an LED or something inside it to give some kind of standard light?
No, it can be done with the standard flash of the smartphone. So, with the black box, the difference is so small. Then the reflections and all this kind of rays going away are all solved.
Excellent.
So the variation is much smaller, and the software can handle these differences quite well. And we have been doing quite a lot of standardizing and what is it called when matching the especially at low levels, the variation was too big. Not as if it matters a lot, because it doesn't really matter if you have a fasting insulin of 2 or 4, because both can be considered perfect. The problem is not this, but still the variation is 100% if you measure a 2 instead of a 4 or something like that. So some more calibration had to be done to fix this. Actually, we don't have enough sick people. that's a problem. So when extending, we would like not so many enthusiasts who support the project right now, but a little bit more ill people, unfortunately, because we need higher insulins for refining the calibration even further.
Absolutely. And I love that pragmatic solution with the black box. And it sounds like it's tuned. And like, if you're 9 insulin or 7, I mean, is the 2 versus 4 kind of like at higher levels would be more like 6 versus 9 and that kind of thing? Or have you tuned that right down to 1 or 2 units in the below 10 range?
Yeah, it's not far from where it can be really used in real life. But I mean, this all considers healthy people. You know, all these health enthusiasts have crazy low fasting insulin levels, and for them it's usually enough to get a single fasting insulin measured, and then they say, okay, it's 2 or 3 or whatever, I'm perfectly healthy. It's more important for the ill, especially on early stages of derangement, when fasting insulin can be fairly normal. So you measure a 6 or something like that, your GP would tell it's perfectly normal, but your 45-minute or 2-hour insulin can be way above normal. So that's when the postprandial measurements come into the picture, and I think in that range, in already a 45-minute, it's the differences what we see in calibrations between the lab measurements and the LFA measurements are so small, these don't matter much.
Yeah, and that's where it really matters, of course, because you're talking like below 30 good at the 2-hour versus above 40 microunits. So up there, like a unit or so, or a few units, makes almost no difference. So that's excellent. And then Donal, you've been using this technology, this emerging technology that sounds like it's pretty much there now on people, as Gabor just referred to, you want to try it on, people who actually generally have problems. So how's that been going?
Let me share a screen. So
yeah,
this is an example of a real one we shot with a lady who came in who was 62. She's got a BMI of 50. And has been trying to lose weight for many, many years. And just in the month before she came to me, her HbA1c had just crept up to 44, having been in the normal range for the rest of her life. And so she came in fasting, and actually her insulin level, which here is in green, was incredibly low at the beginning, so couldn't record it. And her fasting glucose, you can see, was about 6.1, 6.2. So she was delighted to swallow down 75 grams of glucose, which, if anyone hasn't done it, tastes pretty horrid, even if you have a sweet tooth. And then we measured an hour later, an hour later, and an hour later. So you're getting three readings here of insulin and sugars. And so you can see how glucose climbed. It came to a peak at 12.7 and then gradually came back down. But to try and keep our sugars under control, look what our insulin level did. And you guys were arguing over whether it's 2 or 3 or 5 or 6. Does it matter when it's up this high? So she's really struggling to keep control of that sugar much lower down. So when you then have a conversation with her about hyperinsulinemia, about the fact that if this is what happens when you eat a bit of food, and then most of us are eating 5 or 6 times a day, so your area under the green line is constantly high all day long, you know, and we know what the effect of high levels of insulin all day long tend to have on you, with raised blood pressures, retaining sodium through your kidneys, you know, causing dyslipidemia with the small dels, small dents, LDLs flying around, causing atherogenic problems. So she's gone away completely empowered and has revolutionized her life. So during the week, she's been texting me, telling me for the first time in life, she's enjoying her food. She's now eating twice a day. She happens to be a nurse, so she has access to dipsticks, and she tells me that she's got ketones in her urine, so she's become a fat burner. She's blowing out ketones, urinating ketones. So our good friend Bickman told us during a couple of weeks ago in one of his podcasts, it's a way of getting rid of energy, you know, and if you're not a fat burner, you're not blowing out energy, so the body keeps on losing it and your waist circumference shrinks.
Yeah, and it's huge. If you don't measure it, it don't get fixed, is the old phrase. But I mean, even for people who are not engineers, you know, just having measurements and having a grasp of what's happening and visualizing it and knowing when they put a croissant in their mouth with mixed with some butter, you know, all that refined carbohydrate and butter, what it's doing and how your insulin is hopping up to meet the incoming threat, you know, visualizing it really helps them to stay on the real food. It's important to have a grasp and to understand the numbers. And I think that graph there, I can't remember, it looked like a 2A or a 2B Kraft curve, but I'm a little rusty. But Dr. Gerber, his record is a rather overweight gentleman, I think only in his late 50s, who hit a 560 microunits 2 hours after the glucose. Now, there could have been a laboratory glitch and maybe it was a few, but I've heard often, you know, Dr. Ken Bruckler in New York, a good friend of mine who worked with Joseph Kraft back in the 70s, he began to do these insulin assays on his patients. He was an enterologist, and he began to see numbers here and there regularly of a couple of hundred. And he thought they must have insulinomas, and he sent them for scans, and eventually he realized, my God, you can do this to your body with your diet. He couldn't believe it. He thought it has to be a growth. And he got them on the dietary treatment, you know, the low carb, lower calorie treatment. And he was seeing those curves collapse just like Dr. Kraft was. I mean, this is the way forward.
Absolutely. And the, I don't know if Gabor wants to briefly mention some of the lipidometers that we have access to and how people can measure their triglyceride levels.
Yeah, we also realize that some people are not ready or just don't want or find it too complicated, because you know, also the amount of blood for insulin testing is significantly higher than what you use for glucose. And after some research, we have realized that much of what you do with insulin, not all, but much, can be derived from a combination of glucose and lipid metrics. So combining triglycerides, for example, with glucose or HDL with triglycerides, or you can combine all three and add in waist circumference and different metrics that are there. There are various indices available in the literature. And of course, we could also work on our own when having enough data to play around with. But with a relatively cheap lipidometer, you can establish a glucose, a triglyceride, and an HDL figure. And of course, in a GP practice, measuring waist circumference is not a big issue. So you have very accessible data which could substitute to some extent the insulin metrics, and then you don't even need any complication. It's just the analytics what we need to do. Basically, you need a lipidometer which also measures glucose, and then the interpretation is up to us, and the feedback is up to us. So it's another approach, and this can be combined with further with insulin, of course. The more you measure, the more you know and understand.
Yeah, and there are plenty of anomalous people who have an unusually good metric in one that you would expect to be high, and vice versa. And for the people who really want to go deep, you know, you want all the data you can get. But for most people, for the kind of middle of the road, you know, high A1C, type 2 diabetic, pre-diabetics. Yeah, I agree. The triglyceride and the glucose and the HDL, you put them together, it's pretty powerful. And the other thing about triglyceride is I remember those papers you shared with me years ago, some of my favorite studies of all time. But that one about the meals that were taken, three meals during the day, and you could see the postprandial triglycerides, or it could have been the insulin-sensitive obesity one, also showed that the postprandial, post-meal triglyceride level was extremely responsive to show people with metabolic dysfunction. And I think you're talking now about fasting for those measures, but you're also looking at the dynamic post-meal or post-challenge.
Yeah, precisely. It makes a lot of sense, especially in for average folks who have three mixed meals per day, for example, and you can see the gradual derangement over the day, because their insulin sensitivity improves somewhat overnight, and they are the most insulin sensitive in the morning when they eat their first mixed meal. And already after the second meal, you can see that the baseline is elevated, the spikes are higher, and the third meal is even worse than following the first two. And you see this constant elevation of the baseline, the so-called fasting levels, and then the same or even higher peaks are added on top of the elevated baseline. So the derangement increases over the day. And I mean, this can be circumvented or exploited if we use a so-called tolerance test, a mixed meal tolerance test, early in the morning. So you don't have to wait three meals if you take in, for example, two meals in one, and a moderate protein, high fat, high carbohydrate does the trick. And what you see is really a tolerance test to a hit, when you have to deal with both simple carbohydrates and high fatty acids, lipids in your meal. That's the most difficult for the body to do. And this way you can catch any derangement relatively early.
Yeah, excellent. And you know, a very sensitive test, and also a dynamic responsive test that takes, you know, how your machine is responding after actually putting it under load. Because the fasting tests can be really tricky, absolutely. And I remember that paper now, it's coming back to me. What I loved about it was when they did the healthy and the not so healthy people, and they were having the three mixed meals, and they were actually radionucleotide tracking the fat molecules from the food and seeing where it went. And just the summary for people watching, a lot of people are still worried about their ApoB particle count number going up, even though we say it's not really the number, that's just a proxy for insulin resistance and the real problems. But interestingly, the healthy people, most of the fat molecules from the meal ended up going to their adipose tissue and then coming back out later, which is exactly how the body should work. But the unhealthy people, the fat molecules from the meal were being kind of more directed to the liver, not taken up by their adipose tissue or their fat, more going to the liver and then ending up in a flood of ApoB particles driving up the particle number. So, you know, the dysfunction of adipose tissue and the problem of insulin resistance, it really is the quarterback, the heavy hitter of metabolic disease. And a lot of these cholesterol things are just kind of responding to the orders that are coming from a dysfunctional system. So, yeah, where do we go from here, actually? Yeah.
So what's useful about this is for somebody like me, as a fairly ordinary, typical GP, is I can now get a machine that looks like a glucometer. I can measure glucose. I can measure triglycerides. And previously, my knowledge is not so great as Gabor's massive head. So when some of the numbers come back to me, I'd be scratching my head wondering, what do I do now? So the link up with metabolic is I can ping Gabor a message to say, here's my mixed meal test, Gabor. Don't quite fully understand it. And I'm getting an immediate interpretation back. You know, that so I can make sense of this with the patient beside me. And then we can all have an informed conversation about where we go, which is a lot more powerful than the old paternalistic way of, you know, me doing a blood test, you having to wait 2 or 3 weeks to find out what the result was. And I can hardly remember what we talked about when I saw you 2 or 3 weeks ago. And for 20 years, I was watching the amount of triglycerides coming in, slowly rising. And I had no idea what to do about it. So the usual advice was, let's repeat it in 6 months when I probably still won't know what to do about it. But it's kind of pushed it out a bit on the long finger.
I was going to say, you got rid of that person for 6 whole months. So that's a result.
And so I can remember 3 or 4 years ago, put my head in my hands thinking, what have we been doing for the last 15, 20 years? Rising LFTs, rising triglycerides, increasing your metformin, take more exercise, and nothing ever worked. And then once you get the advice a little bit right, you get dramatic responses. So I was staggered at how quickly people's blood sugars corrected. Amazed to see you can turn fatty liver around in 4 weeks. It was phenomenal.
It is amazing to watch. And I think my record almost was a Asian extraction, a portly gentleman, shall we say. He was quite overweight in Denver last March, came running up to me and said, Ivor, you saved my life. And he hugged me, bear hugged me, you know, and I go, what? And that was just before coronavirus, really. So big hug. And he said, Ivor, I got your book 10 months ago. I'm a internal medicine specialist, whatever. I've been type 2 diabetic for over 10 years. And I look fat now, but I've lost 35 pounds in the last 10 months. And he said, you know how long it took me to take my type 2 diabetes glucose levels down to non-diabetic? And I said, well, I guess you're going to say a couple of weeks or... And he said, 10 days. I tested myself 10 days later, but he said also my insulin collapsed 10 days later. So within 10 days, his insulin collapsed. So I've also heard stories regularly enough that the A1C, even though it's a nominal 3 month kind of metric for the degree of glycosylation or glycation of your red blood cells. I've heard stories as well of people whose A1C drops much faster than it even should. Like within 4 weeks, they test again and it's already dropped, even though it's a 3 month metric. So it's just stunning what can be done. And, you know, I was just thinking when you said mixed meals and 3 meals and they eat the meal, Gabor, in the morning and their insulin sensitivity drops back and the second meal, it gets worse. Third meal, it gets really bad. Can you imagine they had 3 or 4 egg yolk omelet for the breakfast and then they just had a piece of steak for lunch? And then in the evening, they had a couple of mackerel fish. I mean, what would that day look like for these people?
Yeah, it's not a good model for us because then you see these flat lines. it's quite boring, but the effect is profound, definitely.
But exactly, it just shows you what we're sitting on here is astonishing that we just listed out a few simple meals that if you ate those every day, within days, your diabetes would be going into remission. Literally within days, your insulin would be collapsing. The thing that's driving a lot of the damage, your leptin will be collapsing. Your appetite lack of control will be relieving. you know, your triglycerides will be collapsing. We know that triglycerides disrupt the appetite control system, as does insulin, as does hyperleptinemia. So we've got all of the core pillars of modern chronic disease, the biochemical kind of quarterbacks that are the problem. And we've just said there's a handful of different foods you can eat, and within days and certainly weeks, you'll collapse the big problem. And no doctor really knows this. Doctors are still telling people, they're writing to me, these guys, the doctor insisted to them, there's nothing you can do with diet for your heart disease risk, for your diabetes. He said, it's all a fad. It's a myth. It's crazy.
So what we're trying to do over here now is, can we do this at a population level? So you very kindly introduced me to another Irishman a few months back who manages a digital online platform. So we're using that platform in a population in England. So we had to do some translation from Cork accents to Havant accents. But it's really interesting what's happened. So we went to one of the practices there with somebody who understands what's going on and has embraced the whole concept. And he himself used the platform. The lead GP in the practice has now lost 17 kilograms, barely recognizable from the start of the project. And then we did a quick search in his computer and identified a cohort of patients who are on GLP-1 injections. 70% are on insulin, they're on glycoside, they're on the metformin, they're on the flozins, you know, and a whole raft of antihypertensives, statins, and piles of other medications. So here's a group that we can't turn around, right? Because they've had diabetes for years, on so much drugs because the disease is out of control. How can simple food turn this around? So we identified them. We invited them to come on the project. We sent them a link to register. We were told, because this is a very poor, deprived area, these people won't be able to register on an online system. They all got the link. They all registered. One guy had difficulty because he had an iPhone 4. Right? I had an iPhone 4, so there was challenges with answering some of the questions. Everyone else got on it. And so the program has now been running for 3 weeks. So we haven't got our second tranche of bloods with regards to HbA1c's and lipids. But everyone who was on insulin and glycoside were told to immediately halve their doses on day one. Okay. And within the first 7 to 10 days, their sugars have gone from the 20s down to 5s. So within 7 to 10 days, okay. So they're, you know, and reducing big doses of insulin. And there's about a 30 to 40% improvement in glycemic control across the whole group. They're reporting to us on a daily basis their finger prick sugars. There's significant weight loss across the group. So in 3 weeks, a number of them have lost 5 to 6 kilograms and more. And they're all, a lot of them are reporting improved energy, improved sleep, improved well-being, improved clarity of thought. You know, and it's, you know, food as medicine is really, really powerful. And, you know, we need to get that message out there that it is as powerful as any pharmaceutical, probably more.
Yeah, and I think that sounds fantastic. That's only a couple of weeks. And it was you guys were advising from day one, knowing what would happen when they switched to real food to have certain medications, because you don't want them to kind of shoot too low, like with the hypertension drugs and everything, as their body gets fixed. But a couple of weeks, you're talking 6-7 kilos, which for the Americans is nearly 20 pounds, but maybe 16, 17, 18 pounds. 20s of millimoles for blood glucose dropping down into the 5s, which is close to or pretty much normal. So all of this happening within 2 weeks. And what do you think, as they persist, Do you think psychologically, I guess with the app you mentioned and our mutual friend, that's a great system because the app keeps you engaged and the support and coaches, that's really important. So you reckon these guys will kind of pretty much stick with it, especially with the short-term benefits hitting them, like mental acuity, you know, energy, feeling better, losing weight. It often comes off the face first. So it's very pleasing. Your first few pounds begins to come off the face and you look really good, relatively. Do you think psychologically they're going to stick with it? They're motivated? They're on the road?
So compliance is really high. So we have a webinar once a week. So myself, the lead GP, Andrew from Cork, the pharmacist, and the diabetic nurse get together and we have a conversation every week with everyone on the program in it. And they can fire questions in at us. They also have the ability to communicate on the platform, a bit like a Facebook group. They can talk to each other. Mm. Great conversations going on. So there's a community developing of self-help, self-support that's really working well. And from a system point of view, first of all, we believe we can reverse roughly 50% of these people will get into remission. The cost to the system, just in drugs on each of these people, is about £2,000 per year. So if you get into remission, you don't need those drugs. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out how much you're going to save. And on the others, there will be improvement in drug expenditure. There will be improvement in outcomes. There'll be less outpatient appointments, less GP appointments. And more importantly, these people are going to get their lives back. They're going to be able to spend time with their families, their grandchildren, when COVID allows us to give each other a good hug again, a bit like your man in, was it Denver, giving you that bear hug? And that we're missing that. We're missing the real human contact in these days.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And, you know, we'll probably move on from the topic now, but there's huge hope now for these automated systems. And I'm guessing, Gabor, that or Donal, you can link in with Gabor now and get the interpretation. Interpretation is everything, of course. That's where the genius is. Whatever about all of the systems to track, trace, record, apps, engage the client, the interpretation is the key. But AI over time, artificial intelligence and algorithms that are very dependable can replace some of the time-consuming contacting people to check stuff, I guess.
So I think, for me, I think the next bit of the experiment will be, so hospitals will have said craft testing is really expensive because it chews up so much time in a hospital. Mm-hmm. These bits of kit are very transportable. So, people can do glucometers at home. Why couldn't they do a triglyceride glucose mixed meal test at home? Report the numbers back in. I'll have a chat with Gabor. And we can then have profound conversations that will genuinely turn people's lives around.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I was actually thinking, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, that the interpretation currently is linking in with, say, Gabor or whatever. But over time, maybe with development of algorithms and smart kind of AI, maybe even some of the interpretation can be computer generated, and then with any doubt whatsoever, okay, having to go back to an actual person. But you know, there's probably going to be layers.
Yeah, I think that's the basic idea to get it to not fully, but at least partly automated. And in general, I think it's also a kind of an education, ongoing education for the GPs who are involved, that they could do all the typical patterns after a while. I mean, it just takes time to see more data and more data and more graphs and more curves and more curves. And then you just have a look at it after a couple of weeks or months doing it on a daily basis. And you can tell 90% of the time that it's a pattern, two, three, whatever, if you stick to the craft or what is the health most likely have status of the individual at hand. So and then there always remains a few peculiar guys with very unusual figures, And then, we can discuss it on a weekly or whatever basis. What this could be, do a little research if it's really outstanding and unusual. But eventually, the ultimate goal is to reach a high level of automation in this when the software already gives back results and some estimations that you are most likely pre-diabetic, consult with your GP or whatever.
Yeah, and over time, maybe more unusual cases will emerge as patterns in their own right and will kind of be characterized and then become kind of automatically suggested. But yeah, that's longer term. The coronavirus, we don't want to go down a hole in that. I've spent a lot of time in that over the last year, but maybe some thoughts on the sheer exposure. I mean, if you are leptin resistant, which is insulin resistant, type 2 diabetic physiology, there's so many mechanisms that will increase your risk of severe outcome versus a very minor outcome. So what do you think? I mean, this chronic disease epidemic for the last 40 years has left us in a shockingly bad state to handle a new severe virus of this type. And then when the aged people are being hit, it's an easy excuse to say, oh, well, that's because they're elderly, but it's because they're metabolically failing. And yet we kind of aged people and we know them. I know a guy who's 88 and he's in excellent health and he does a little farming and he works away. You know, there are choices there too, that you could even be in your 80s and be relatively very low risk having caught this virus by having metabolic health and low insulin resistance and low leptin resistance also. So it's a huge thing.
I mean, this is a clash of two pandemics, isn't it? It's a clash of two pandemics that's causing chaos.
Perhaps three, because another one is the vitamin D deficiency. But of course, obesity, insulin resistance is related to low vitamin D levels circulating, because it's not fully independent. But still, I think it's kind of a third factor which should be incorporated. And I think we are also close to being able to measure vitamin D, 25-OH vitamin D at home with the same system I mentioned, with the shooting box and with the lateral flow assay. It's not so difficult. So we are currently evaluating suppliers, to put it nicely, because some are not fully reliable and some countries of origin are problematic, so we need to pick the right one. But there are several options, fortunately, so we strongly hope that it can be solved very soon. And then you can do a insulin measurement and a vitamin D measurement in parallel. And then you can also do a COVID test, which is also a lateral flow assay, so it can be done within the same system very easily. And we can probably produce a risk calculator, for example, for this virus, but this may not be as unique as believed. So there are other problems, infectious diseases, which correlate fairly well with metabolic health in general.
Yeah, and vitamin D. And I actually love the way you described that, because I was very careful to say to people that vitamin D or low vitamin D, 25-OHD in your blood, is a proxy or reflects a metabolic problem or an autoimmune problem or an inflammatory problem or insulin resistance problem. So there's a bit of confounding there. Treat it as a marker of a problem, a metabolic problem. And it's not just chug the pills, get the number forced up and feel you're as healthy as another 35 nanogram person because you've jacked up to 35 with pills. But like you say, the vitamin D in itself, though, also stands alone. I think a couple of Spanish studies in the last 6 months have shown pretty strong outcomes from taking it.
A lot of attacks of these guys. It's crazy what's going on. When you have a mainstream article, it's published in JAMA, and they administer a single bolus dose of, I think, 200,000 units in one day after admission, and then nothing happens, nothing good at least, And then on release, they claim that after 7 days, their levels came back normal. So, but what happened within that 7 days? Nobody is interested in. So, and then it's in JAMA, but the other one, the Spanish you refer to, has already been withdrawn from the preprint server because of the attacks. So,
there were two. There was an original Spanish one.
There was a pilot study, and then the larger scale study was put up a couple of weeks ago on a preprint server, and they had quite nice results reported in mainstream media as well. But by this time, I think 1 or 2 weeks later, it's disappeared because it was attacked by not proper randomization. They randomized wards and not people, but it started back in March or April last year. So there was no clear cure. There was no treatment at all for the severe condition. So they just decided that this ward will do the vitamin D, the other one will be the control, and that was it. I think it was not a poor design back then, but it seems a bit poor design right now. But I don't think it deserves retraction at this stage when it's in the preprint stage. It's crazy. And then you know that they use the 25-OHD, the intermediate metabolite, which is normally produced by the liver, but it takes a lot of time for the liver to convert that huge amount of vitamin into the intermediate form, which can be then utilized by the immune system directly. So if you don't want to wait and you treat moderate or severe people, you really need to use the one readily available. And I think they did it good. That's the right design. You could do the same by using, I don't know, 15, 20K units a day for a couple of weeks, but you don't have a couple of weeks. That's the problem.
Yeah, and that was a key point with that one. And one more study similar to it. I'm shocked. I'm still dealing with the shock that it was retracted because I see that as pretty much pure corruption. Because if that was a patented drug and it was looking good, and even if it was ward-based, it would be celebrated across the board. But because it's actually a threat to patented drugs and could be a huge embarrassment, I think that's where all the heat comes to force these teams to back off. And I know it sounds a bit conspiracy, but to me, it's just business. We've become a corporatized world, and this stuff is going on all the time. But anyway, yeah, a really important point. They didn't take the D3 that you out there would buy in bottles, the vitamin D3. That's got to go in, be metabolized through the liver, and it's a steady process. It's converted into 25-OHD. And in these experiments, they gave them the 25-OHD. So it's immediately going to be active in the body, which is what you need if you want to give patients something that needs to act now within the coming days as their infection gets worse. Whereas D3, you'd want to start weeks before and build up your D levels. And we know from the studies, taking a few thousand IUs of D, you need to go weeks and weeks and weeks to steadily bring up your blood level. So of course the experiment should use 25-OHD, the blood component. And I did an interview with David Grimes and a couple of other doctors a couple of weeks ago. And in Italy, over the counter, you can buy vials of this 25-OHD apparently. And it's really inexpensive. And it's one of the only countries where you can just get it cheaply.
Yeah, it also absorbs nicely if you take it with some fat. It's a fat-soluble vitamin, so you need to add some fat. But D doesn't require a huge amount of fat. Then it's K2, the vitamin K2, which requires 30-something grams of fat for proper absorption. But D is just fine. I think it's these little capsules with olive oil or whatever inside the capsules can accommodate 10K. Of D, and it will absorb no problem.
Yeah, the 10,000 I think are the higher end capsules, but 5,000 IUs are quite common capsules. So is there anything else? I knew we wanted to keep this one pretty tight and cover the core. Any other thoughts as we curl into a close or we on the cover?
No, with that cohort in hand, we'll be reporting at 4, 8, and 12 months. So if you want to get back together, maybe in a year's time, we can give you the updated numbers.
Oh, yeah. Or even, you know, maybe in a few months when your first kind of successes come in. Absolutely. We can have a quick chat. And Gabor, before we go, you owe me a podcast on the immune system and SARS-CoV-2, and also maybe touch on the origins of SARS-CoV-2.
Oh, that's a bit more speculative.
That's thing,
even compared to vitamin D. I mean, a lot of people claim that I speculate about vitamin D, but you know, I like to think of myself as a guy of mechanisms. So I try to look under the hood all the time, and then I see that all the mechanisms are there for vitamin D. For example, it shouldn't be surprising that it has a profound effect on immune function, because that's how it works. But you really need to understand that's why dosing, for example, is very important, and what molecule is given and what dosage is. It's not a drug. It's a nutrient, and or it's a metabolite of a nutrient. It's a pro-hormone, and it doesn't follow a linear association with dosing. You cannot just launch in a few hundred thousand units and wait for the magic to happen, because it's not how it works in the body. You have these immune cells, one converting the vitamin to the other one, because it doesn't express the other one. The T cell doesn't express the enzyme for it. So the dendritic cell comes along and converts it for the T cell. So it's quite fancy, but requires some level of mechanistic understanding, I think.
Well, exactly. And I know this one was not meant to get into some heavy detail, but what we'll do is in the next day or two, we'll meet up again and go into that. The T cell immunity, the interaction with vitamin D, the immune system in general, what's salient to your susceptibility. And maybe we talk of T cell cross immunity, like in Japan, where they got 50% antibodies nearly in Tokyo, but almost no impact. But people think that Japan somehow avoided spreading the virus. But there's a whole cohort of several hundred, and they hit nearly 50% antibodies over a couple of months in the surge. So that's the whole T cell potential cross immunity. And then we'll touch on, but we'll be careful, because these days, sadly, there is apparently 1984 style censorship. But we'll be careful when we're talking about the origins of the virus, and We won't get too controversial, just in case. Is that fair?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Let's do it, maybe even at the weekend. Listen, Donal, that's superb work, both on your own journey of achieving health and also this amazing stuff you're doing with these, let's be honest, super exposed, super high-risk individuals transforming their lives with all this technology that's coming out.
Thank you so much.
Great stuff. Thanks a lot, guys, and we catch up soon.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
And just a reminder that I do need support to continue putting together all of this content. And at patreon.com/IvorCummins or for PayPal at tinyurl.com/IvorCummins, where you can do a one-off or a monthly support. So I'd really appreciate that, guys, and keep me getting the science out there and countering perhaps the more biased corporate type science. Thank you.